A little business here at first. I should apologize for the tardiness for this episode. I had intended to get it out around the middle of February, and here it is, you know, nearly March 1st, and I'm finally getting it out. But such is the risk and the danger of doing the whole podcast thing entirely on your own and having a life and writing and submitting and you know, the fun stuff. Sorry, I thought I saw a cat sneaking under a door. Anyway, some other business here. We will be on a short hiatus, but should be back soon. We're trying to, you know, convert and do the whole season thing. So I am working on a podcast about Ulysses and James Joyce with a friend of mine from graduate school, Delia Tramontina, and we're going to be getting that ready, I hope, to come out sometime around Bloomsday. Also beginning work on another short series with a friend, Todd Robbins, about crime and the various bad business around, okay, I'll just say it, noir, I've been made paranoid about the pronunciation of that word by an ex. I took Russian, not French, and that's apparently a French word, and I can't ever pronounce it right. Of course, I also have been told that I pronounce dog funny, so whatever. Anyway, today's guest on this special bonus episode is Caitlin Hamilton Sumi. Caitlin is the author of the collection To Lay to Rest Our Ghost, which is out, and you should go get it. It's from Fomite Press. Caitlin's also been had a long and storied career as a book publicist for places like McMurray and Beck and Unbridled Books and Blue Hen Press that used to be with Penguin. So, you know, she knows quite a bit about the book industry, and we talk about it here, and it's a very excellent conversation, and just to hit it one more time, you should go out and grab her collection To Lay to Rest Our Ghosts. So I'm going to shut up here and get to the conversation with Caitlin.
This is the Outrider Podcast.
I did get the time right, 2 Central, and you're on Eastern, right?
I am on Eastern. Yep, I'm sitting right here, hiding up in my room.
Excellent.
Away from all...
Away from what?
All the kids and noise and chaos.
I wish I could get away from the noise and chaos that my cats cause, but if I lock them out of the room, they'll just sit by the door and bang on it and howl and, you know, scratch at it. But fortunately, they're asleep behind me, or at least pretending to be.
Oh, there we go. Okay, I can hear you now.
Okay. So let's start.
Okay.
Well, I'm gonna jump right to your bio, because, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of people listening. Not that I have a lot of people listening, but
I'm sure you have more than you
than
think.
I assume. Yep.
So, yeah.
Your bio seems to suggest you've bounced around quite a bit. Where are you from originally?
I'm originally from outside Boston, and I spent about half my childhood there. And then we moved to the Minneapolis area, and I spent about half my childhood there. And then I went to college outside of Massachusetts, Boston, Massachusetts. And then I ended up in graduate school in Colorado and stayed there a while. And then after a while there, we moved to Tennessee. Yep. So I've lived in every region of the country, and within Colorado, and I think I may have the count wrong, but I think I moved 4 or 5 times just in the state of Colorado, because of life things and life changes. So by the time we moved to Tennessee, I told my husband, I was never moving after we bought a house. I was never moving again. This was it. Yeah. Because we've always moved ourselves. Cross country with children, whatever. We've always moved ourselves. And so once we bought a house, I said, never again. This is it.
You're done packing boxes. So,
I'm still unpacking boxes.
Yeah.
When we moved to this house, we had been married, I think, 10 years, maybe more. Again, I'm not great with the dates of things sometimes. But at that time, I started unpacking our wedding gifts.
Wow.
Because we had packed them up, planning after our marriage to move to a different community to lessen business commute, work commute. So we thanked everybody and we packed them up. And then we bounced around so much after that, that yes, it was about 10 years later and I was unpacking.
So you, when you were in Colorado, you were in Fort Collins, Colorado State, right? That's where you did your MFA?
What years
were you there, in particularly Fort Collins?
I think I was there from 92 to 95 or 91 to 94.
Okay.
The CSU MFA is 3 years instead of the normal two. And then I think it goes to 3 years because they require a year or so of the study of literature. So it really extends the program. And they don't allow you to defend your creative thesis until you've passed a comprehensive exam in literature.
Wow.
So their structure is a little different. Yeah, wow, indeed, because my major was Middle Eastern history and my minor was philosophy. So I came into the program and still have huge gaps in my reading. So that year was really powerful and wonderful and inspiring. But it was also a little intimidating because I didn't have the background that most of my colleagues had. They'd sit around and talk about books that I'd never read.
Right.
That were on the comp list, you know? And so it was kind of intense and intimidating too, but glorious.
I don't know that I've talked to any writer who doesn't in some way feel they're a little behind or shortchanging themselves as readers of literature. You know, there's
always... Well, that's good to hear. Yeah.
Well,
I'm not alone.
No, not at all. I mean, I'm working with a friend of mine right now from graduate school, Delia, and we're going to do a whole series for the podcast where we're going to read Ulysses because we both managed to finish an MFA program, me, an MFA and a BA in creative writing, and never read Ulysses.
I've never read it.
And so we're going to sit down and read that. And I got done talking to Duncan, another grad school acquaintance, who also was, you know, he said when he got into the PhD program, you know, he said he had to read 10 books for every one book that, you know, his classmates read because he was so far behind. And I'm thinking, you might have overdid it. And he's...
Maybe he did, maybe. But it's interesting to hear that that's the case and that I'm not alone because... It was a little intimidating to come into conversations and not have, you know, anything to contribute. And so just to sit and listen is fine, but it was sort of a dawning realization that I really needed to get reading because of the CSU program, you know, at another MSA, it probably would have been intimidating, but without the same level of intense pressure. At a certain point, I had to get cracking.
Right, right.
Yeah. Which I did.
I think sometimes, though, you know, I think writers, we hold ourselves to a standard that we probably shouldn't. Just as, well, we're writers. We're in the process of creating, and that comes out of life, not necessarily out of the stuff that we've read, although it's good to have read something. I mean, the worst thing in the world is listening to someone read poetry who's write poetry who's never read it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's an interesting point, because I think that when you're writing, mm-hmm. I'm sure everyone has their influences, but I think by and large, sometimes we get stuck in our own heads too much as writers.
Right.
And that it is life, it is our experience, it's our emotional landscape that's going to drive our prose mm-hmm. and our poetry. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting, you know, to hear you say that, because I don't think that people talk about that as much as they talk about what they've read, what they've studied, theory. Mm-hmm. And I think probably because it's easier to talk about than our lives. But I do think that at the end of the day, what makes our prose shine or not, or our poetry shine or not, is the ways we've connected to the human experience through our own lives. Even if we're imagining, as you did so beautifully in The Evolution of Shadows, there's so much that you... Oh, but you know I love that book.
Thank you.
You know, but it was a book that in which you had to imagine a great deal, and you were able to through your empathy. And I think that I think that gets short shrift sometimes in conversations about writing. Maybe not, but I've felt that.
Well, good. Thank you.
I'm gonna
turn it about on you and tell you how much I love your collection here. I think I wrote something about it on the blog post recently, but it was, there's so much in here that I like. This is like right up my alley, you know, broken relationships and heartache and you know, and failure. And there's so much of that, you know, raw humanity in here. Oh, I loved it very much, Caitlin. I'm very impressed. I've been recommending it to friends and asking other unbridled writers, have you read this yet?
Oh my gosh, no. The unbridled writers. Oh no. Talk about pressure.
Oh my God. You know, well, you're part of the family one way or the other. I mean, how many of us have you, you know, pushed our books onto unsuspecting readers.
Well, it's very kind of you to say all those things and to advocate for mine. Thank you. I appreciate it a lot.
And it's worth it.
And I'm very relieved that you liked it.
So that kind of brings me to my other thing. I mean, you did this MFA in the early 90s. When mm-hmm. did you get into book publicity and how?
Oh, that's an interesting story. So I was, I had come to Colorado after a stint in independent bookselling in Minneapolis and mm-hmm. after a stint in editorial at Vintage Books Random House in New York.
What bookstore in Minneapolis?
I was with Odegaard Books of Minneapolis, which now sadly no longer exists.
Yeah.
But it was sort of one of the wonderful independents they have mm-hmm. there. I was there for a year and I did their event.
Yeah, they've got a great community up there.
They've got a what? I'm sorry.
A great community up there, a great literary community up there.
Oh, they do. It's fabulous. And so when I went to Colorado and thought about things and had graduated, I really did not want to go back to books. I was interested in social work. I was interested in other things. But I wasn't really finding things that would work. I was trying to get into things like alumni relations departments and different things that involve sort of working with people. Yeah. And I didn't want to go back to school again and start, you know, a master's of social work. And one day I just thought, you know, I probably need to look at books again and just give it another go. And so I had an informational interview at a university press. And unfortunately, it was a fabulous job. It would have been fabulous. But unfortunately, you know, they just couldn't pay very much. Right. And I knew after I did the math that if I could afford the car to get me there, I couldn't pay for the gas. Mm. I mean, it was that little. And so I just declined. But word got out that I was looking, and I'm not sure how, really, but at some point, Fred Ramey got my name at McMurray and Beck. Uh-huh. And he gave me a call and said that he was interested in speaking with me about being his marketing director. And I distinctly remember, I'm sure he remembers some version of this as well, that my response was that I really appreciated him calling, but I didn't want to waste his time or mine.
Right.
Because I didn't have any experience in marketing. And he said, well, why don't you come down and we'll just have a talk about it. So I drove from Fort Collins to Denver, and I really liked what I heard, and I really liked, you know, the Journal of Antonio Montoya, and some of the other books he gave me to read. So right. I decided to take the job. And, and I think one of the main drivers was, you know, he used to say things to me like, you're about to run into a wall. Because I handled all the marketing and the publicity with some help from two other wonderful women, Leslie and Jennifer. But the bulk of it was on my desk. And then when we left the distributorship, I did all sales nationwide, all accounts, mom and pops B&N. And so Fred would say, you know, you're about to run into a wall, Caitlin, because I was just going 150 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. But the last thing I wanted to do was to let this man down who had given me a job, knowing what my experience was. You know, I just was not going to let him down. And so I worked my head off for 4 years.
Tends to inspire that in people, I think, from everything I've heard.
Yeah, he inspires great loyalty. And he's a really good guy.
Yes, he is.
And I think with that, on top of the fact that he'd given me a chance, a huge chance, you know, there were other people he interviewed. So it was sort of like, you know, if he's a great person and he's given me this fabulous opportunity and I cannot fail,
right,
was basically my attitude. I cannot fail. And the other thing is, if I failed, then whole dreams and ships and worlds went out. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you imagine if you were a writer and you'd finally gotten a contract and then you had a lousy marketer, you know?
Right,
so.
Right.
You know, it wasn't just Fred. I felt a significant obligation to my people, and I still do, you know, regardless of what the structure is. If I'm working through my firm or hired, you know, I feel tremendous obligation to the writers who've entrusted me with their stories.
Well, I've only ever heard wonderful things about you, by the way, as far as the book.
Well, thank God.
Well. I mean, when I signed with Unbridled and mentioned that, I think, to Andrea Portes, she was like, oh, you'll love Caitlin. And I was like, okay.
Oh, I'm so glad. I've really lost touch with her, except on Facebook. We just connected on Facebook a couple years ago. But for a long while, I had lost touch with her, and it's lovely to be back in touch.
Yeah, she's been quite busy, I guess.
She's publishing right and left.
I know. And then the kid, and then the movie, and then Morris Hollywood stuff. She's all over the place.
She's famous. And I'm glad she can have that. I sure don't want that, but I'm glad for her.
Oh my. So you started off with Fred at McMurray and Beck, and you went with him then to Penguin too? Or
after McMurray and Beck, you know, I had some choices at a certain point, and I realized that I needed to move on.
Right.
Because I was so exhausted, honestly, and trying to face sort of a rebuilding phase that the press was potentially going through at that time. I just thought, you know what? I don't have it. I don't have it, and I need to let some fresh blood in here and some new ideas. So I left, and I was looking at different options, and Fred and Greg called, and in some ways, it was the perfect call, because they knew I was looking, And they knew that I had a lot of chutzpah, so I was ready to fight again. but it was a different kind of thing. It wasn't rebuilding something. Mm-hmm. It was building something new, and that greatly intrigued me. Oh, wow. And so when I considered the options I had at the time, I thought, you know, I could stay at M&B, but I think they really need an infusion of fresh ideas. Mm-hmm. I could go to X, but I don't know if I, you know, I don't know that that's the right fit for me.
Right.
And, you know, kind of casting around it, I could go with Fred and Greg, where there is a comfort level and a familiarity, mm-hmm. but it's brand new.
Right.
And I loved the idea that it was brand new. And of course, Fred and Greg. So that was the option I chose. And so I went on with them to Penguin Putnam.
Cool. Okay, yeah. Two things.
And then after that, mm-hmm. oh, go ahead.
Well, what was that like working for one of the big conglomerates that, and were you writing the whole time that you were doing all of this?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Okay, so I really was happy at Penguin Putnam. Mm-hmm. In lots of ways. In the end, reflecting on it, it wasn't a great fit in some ways because I'm so used to what a smaller operation allows in terms of freedom mm-hmm. and flexibility.
Right.
And so I really loved my experience there and indeed was happier in some ways.
Yeah.
But in the end, when it was all said and done and I'd left and gone solo and they'd left and started Unbridled and stuff like that, it's better for me to be flexible. It's mm-hmm. better for me to be able to be inventive and not to have a huge structure around.
Right.
So Penguin Putnam was great because I got to go back to a big house and try a different kind of role and a mm-hmm. fabulous experience in a lot of ways, but it helped me hone in on where I'm best.
Right.
And I'm best in a smaller team. Was I writing the whole time?
Yep.
Yes, with gaps. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I had, there's a story in my collection called Geographies of the Heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that story, I believe I started in 1997 and 1998.
Wow.
And that was right in the thick of it with McMurray and Beck. And I started sending it out in 2000 and nobody wanted it.
Uh-huh.
And then it sat for a long time. And again, with the dates, you know, things get a little fuzzy. I know I had somebody read it in 2009 and offer feedback.
Uh-huh.
Some of the feedback was helpful. Much of it didn't quite work for me.
Right.
It didn't make sense to me. I felt like I had a different vision of the story. So, you know, I finally pulled it out, I guess, in 2015 or 2016 again and looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
And, decided I liked it. And, you know, I took a chance and sent it off and long story short, accepted it. And they made a really fabulous edit at a certain point. They said,
right.
They said, do you realize you switch tenses? Sometimes you're past and sometimes you're present. I had no idea. And isn't it funny? After how many years with this piece?
Right.
So, and like, I mean, there was like a 9-year gap at one point. It wasn't like I was slaving yeah. over it, but you know, I switched it to present tense at a certain point.
Right. But
and it changed the pace of the story, which I think was the criticism I received in 2009 was that it was maybe a little slow, maybe a little dull.
Uh-huh.
And I think, you know, that one edit made all the difference. And so I was kind of glad that I didn't try and reshape the story.
Right.
Because that wasn't really the issue. The issue was when to turn up the gas on it and mm-hmm. get it back to present tense. And so very subtle edits, fascinating process to see what shifted once that went to present tense. So yeah, I mean, I'm always writing.
Interesting. Are there any stories in that collection that, you know, survived graduate school?
8 of the 10 stories were written between 1992 and 1995.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And were they all just kind of trickled out into publications since then?
No, let's see. So I published Tags, Fish Eyes and Moonlight, and I published Points of Exchange all about the year and a half after I graduated.
Oh, wow.
And then everything went in shelves, and I was focusing on Geographies of the Heart and the novel.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also called Geographies of the Heart. And I didn't really, I tried to send geographies out, etc. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember trying to send very many of the others out. I may have, most of them went in drawers.
Right.
And then when I started sending, taking root out, I began to slowly look at, you know, geographies of the heart or some of the others at a certain point. Mm-hmm. And the second one I sent out was Sun. And when it was accepted in, I think, June of 2015, nobody had taken root. And I just thought, you know what, I'm going to pull them all out. And I pulled them all out and I started sending them out, any of them that weren't published. Wow. And, And Mark Estrin had contacted me about a year before saying, do you have a book? And I said, I really appreciate you asking, but no. Wild laughter following all that. But right. Once I started pulling the stories out, I thought, you know what? Maybe. And I counted and I had 11, but I didn't think and still don't think the 11th is as strong. So I said, I've got 10. I threw them together. I asked Mark if he still was interested, and he said yes, so I emailed it over. So, I mean, a lot of things sat for a long time.
Okay, that fascinates me. That just, because when I finished graduate school, I kind of abandoned the short story. I have probably about 10 or 11 short pieces that were all written through graduate school. One of them, called Among Predators, was the story that got me an honorable mention at the Atlantic Monthly Student Writing Competition mm-hmm. in 99. Mm-hmm. And I had tried sending that out and it never got accepted. There were a couple of others I had sent out and, you know, they were always rejected. And, you know, then I had Evolution of Shadows in the can, and another mm-hmm. one that shall remain nameless and buried in a drawer. Mm. You know, and... Mm-hmm. I guess I had this impression going in at some point that the thing that was holding back my short fiction was this kind of excessive open-endedness, that I couldn't keep them compact enough to them to make sense as a story. There was just too much story there, and so they made more sense as novels. And so that's where I was going to focus my interest and my attention was on novels. But lately, as I've been sitting here now with two manuscripts I'm trying to find homes for, and I have the urge to start another book, but I'm thinking, why don't you let that sit for a while, read some more, and work on short fiction? And I read a short piece at an open mic reading some friends hold around here, and I read Among Predators and got really good response from the audience about it. And I thought, well, I'll go back in and rework it. It was a little mm-hmm. bit out of date, and there was no way to really. Okay, I don't know if you have noticed this, because I want to ask this about these stories too, because having them been written in the early 90s, although you span a lot of different decades, there's the first story tags is World War II contemporary, you know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. Did you have to go back into any of your stories because of the time between they were originally written and the time you were trying to place them again? Did you update them?
That's an interesting question. I would say I would encourage you to give your short fiction a second chance. But in terms of timing, I decided that they were what they were. Mm-hmm. And I was not going to update them. And I liked them the way they were too. Right. What I did do is, you know, I don't even know if I'd sent Sons out. I don't know if I'd ever, I'm pretty sure I never once sent Brothers anywhere. There were a couple stories that I just didn't think people would like, that I liked, namely Brothers. Mm-hmm. And I just sort of thought, you know what? I like it. And what I did do was I realized there were some issues with time and logistics in a couple of stories. And,
right.
you know, just I, for instance, I in Brothers, I had George driving a car at one point. I'm like, he couldn't have. she was, you know, she was already paralyzed. So there were those kinds of inconsistencies I smoothed out in Brothers and in a couple other pieces. But I let them be what they were.
Right.
And in terms of the stories that connect, especially, I did, because they are part of a larger book of a novel. Mm-hmm. And the timing matters.
Right.
Because if I shift them, then the whole novel is going to have to shift mm-hmm. in different ways. So I just let them be what they were. And I was thrilled that people liked them regardless of when they were set.
Right.
They're not timely in, you know, in that way.
Yep. Yes. Okay. Because I was, you know, particularly with Among Predators, I guess at some point between when it was first written and when I looked at it, when I read it out loud to the audience, I had made some edits that then made, well, when I wrote it, I did not have a cell phone in it. They had pagers and they were watching VCRs still and doing VHS tapes. And at some point I had tweaked something early on in the story and then abandoned the edit. So I was reading it out loud to this audience and they're talking about cell phones and things like that. All of a sudden it drops into using a VHS player. And I'm going, well, this feels old.
Well, I think you have to choose.
Yep.
I think you have to choose. And I think that sometimes a lot of it's just instinct, mm-hmm. you know, but I will say, I don't think your book has, your story, pardon me, has to be of this time.
Right.
To be of interest.
Correct.
You know, it really doesn't. If my stories are any indication and some of the other stories that I'm seeing out there, you know, people were accepting of them.
Yep.
I'm sitting here nodding. I realized, wait, we're on a podcast. You can't see that. But I would try it again, especially that piece.
Oh yeah, I'm farting around with it, trying to. Well, I've got a whole bunch of New Year's resolutions. I guess not New Year's resolutions. That seems kind of corny. Goals for this year, you know, to try and get my, shit together.
I think goals are fabulous, and I think New Year's resolutions are not corny. I think that we all need a chance to recharge mm-hmm. and try again and dig in, and we need a little inspiration. So yeah. Whatever you call it. I think that's great. Go for it. Go for it.
My plan to get out of Kansas, but I don't know.
Well, there are lots of places you can go.
Yeah.
Lots of things you could do.
Maybe.
Maybe. Okay.
Maybe. Yeah.
Well.
So you said a couple of these stories are taken from a novel that you're
yes.
trying to find a
yes.
home for right now?
No, I'm trying to finish. I have a solid draft. It's called Geographies of the Heart, mm-hmm. and it is about the McMillan sisters. So
nice.
The stories that are in the novel are Taking Root, Geographies of the Heart, and Patchwork.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there is a lot that, if you have read the stories like yourself, you'll understand there are a lot of unresolved conflicts.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very much the story of these sisters, but uh-huh. I would say about half the book is Al's as well,
right.
because I think as an outsider, he brings a very kind perspective uh-huh. to some of the tension. So, yeah, I have a really solid draft, but it's going to need more time.
Right. So
yeah.
What was it that got you writing about these sisters?
You know, I don't know. I wrote a couple of stories in graduate school that aren't in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I can't remember which came first. I think it was a story called Cleaning House. And that was published in South 85 Journal. And in it, Sarah is trying to come to terms really with her grandparents' impending death.
Right.
That she realizes now that these are probably close at hand.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I ended up writing about another situation mm-hmm. that she shared with Al. And then I just kind of kept going. And I'm pretty sure there was another one And then I think I hit Geography for the Heart. And then I kind of thought, you know, I think I'm working on a novel. And it'll be, you know, maybe somebody else will call it another a collection of stories. But mm-hmm. it's really, because it's all about the same people. Right. I think they're gonna. It would be classified as a novel and stories. And, you know, I was talking to my mom about it, who's one of my very few readers. I think I have two. And I said to Mom, I know how it ends. And she kind of looked at me, you know, uh-huh. and smiled. And I said, and I know the ending's right. Oh, she said, you know, she was really interested, but I can't tell her because she's going to read it for me and give me feedback.
Right.
She's a fabulous reader.
Good.
So, yeah, I'm plugging away on that.
In between
but, you know,
marketing campaigns?
Well, in between working and baseball games and basketball games. And yeah, we have... And the crazy homework they give you now. And but I was going to tell you, I don't think you know this, that really that for the last 5 years, I've been writing a lot for children. Nobody wants any of it. But I've been working on some, you know, a children's middle grade novel. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah. So I kind of just do whatever I want, which is, I guess, sort of similar to what I was saying about work. I like mm-hmm. freedom to...
Right.
I like the freedom to explore, to try new things, uh-huh. or to, you know, and I like that in writing, too. I like flexibility. So
oh,
a big corporation with a lot of rules and a lot of things about who can do what is sort of sometimes a bummer, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I live that every day.
Yeah, you do know that. You do know that. Although, you know, Penguin was very kind. I mean, they let me... In many ways, I had more freedom than a lot of the other marketers.
Right.
They gave me a lot of leeway. Yeah.
Well,
because
probably,
of the structure.
Right. And because of your previous experience and working with
yeah.
Fred and Greg. And
yeah.
So, yeah.
And they knew I had handled, you know, the three different departments. So I think that they were willing to give me some latitude, mm-hmm. which was nice. But there's only so much a person can have in a corporation like that.
Right.
So. But yeah, I like that with the writing too. I like the freedom to explore different things. But I think at this point, I'm pretty much back to Glennie and Sarah now and trying mm-hmm. to nail down, finish their story so I can move on
yeah.
to the next one. Yeah.
So when did you really, really start writing? Was it when you were a kid? Was that just something that you always did? Was it something that your parents encouraged? Or did they kind of...
Well, no, I always wrote and they encouraged me to continue. The story is, according to my mom, that before I learned how to shape letters, uh-huh. I would come down to her with scribbles and ask her to read my story.
Oh, no.
And she, yeah, and I would never have thought of this as a mother. And she would always say, according to her recounting, Caitlin, why don't you read it to me? And I know in fifth grade, we had to write a little story, and then we had to pin them together with little pins. Uh-huh. And we were supposed to write one, and I wrote five or eight.
Yeah.
I wrote a novella by 13, and I had two novels done by 18.
Nice.
So all of those terrible, terrible stories are done, and I still have at least one of them. I think the others are lost on these giant floppy disks somewhere, and I probably right. have the disk, but... So, yeah, I've always written. I mean, for me to... I've always written.
Somewhere in my mom's collection of things in her basement, I think she still has a short story I wrote in the second grade about having a pet
yes.
dinosaur. And I
yes.
have a box in my closet, and I actually have some short stories I wrote in the sixth and seventh and eighth grade. I have the the extended draft... of some novel I tried in high school that was horrible.
And I, you know, well, yes, I look at some of them and I just wince. But, you know, it's really, I think, true that there are a lot of us out there who did start early. Maybe uh-huh. not as many as people who started later in life, but yeah. it's important, I think, to recognize that there's that interest and mm-hmm. that there's that ability. And when I was at CSU, I taught creative writing for a semester. My TA was administrative, but I did
nice.
Teach for a semester. Mm-hmm. And I remember somebody saying, you know, don't expect too much, you know. They're, you know, 17, 18, 19, and just, you know. And I thought to myself, well, because I had always had great passion and been writing. And so right. on the first day of class, I said, how many of you have written novels?
Every
and three
hand
kids
shot
raised
up.
Their hands. Three did. And, nice. You know, I was talking at my one of my kids' career days at school recently, uh-huh. and I was supposed to talk about writing and publishing, and I was supposed to give the same talk three times to three different groups. And after the first one, I realized, I really think they're interested in writing.
Right.
And so the second was more about writing, and the third, I hardly even spoke about publishing at all. But in the second and the third,
yeah.
in the second and third presentation, I said, how many of you are writing books, mm-hmm. novels? And a fair number of hands went up. These kids are 10 and 11.
Right, right.
And I just think that we have to find ways to support that passion in kids,
yeah.
you know?
Because even if it doesn't come to anything, if you support that passion and then you teach them literature correctly, you have
yes.
lifelong readers. And our whole careers as writers and pushers of books, we can expand, you know, that chance.
Yes, and we have the next generation of writers too.
Yeah.
I mean, my parents were always supportive, but they never, I wouldn't say they coddled me. I mean, mm-hmm. I did receive constructive criticism.
Yeah.
I did receive feedback that I think that was encouraging, but not, you know, wild hand clapping and cheers, you know. And yeah. I believe in that too. I mean, I think you have to know what a child can take.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I you know, when I talked at my book launch, I said they gave me the respect of treating me like a real writer in a way,
right.
you know. And so I mean, this is sort of like a huge tangent, I know, and a very huge, giant insert, but yes, I've been writing forever. My parents have been respectfully supportive, and I think all kids should have that. That's the
well,
answer.
I might not have continued to write if my parents together had been terribly supportive. I think to a certain, my mother was, you know, supportive. She did her thing, but I sometimes wonder if that impetus to write, you know, is not in a small way, not in a terribly small way, fueled by my father's seeming indifference.
Interesting. And that's interesting.
I just remember being infuriated with him at one point in high school when I was talking about, you know, wanting to be a writer. And he just kind of, you know, was like, oh, well, you know, you got to have something to fall back on. And this friend of mine who was, you know, in the car at the same time, driving home from somewhere. And he asked my friend what he was going to do. And he's like, no, I think I'm going to be in computer programming. And my dad just, you know, lit up like, oh, that's cool. You know, you can do that with this and stuff. And just this reaction mm-hmm. that I never got from him when I said I wanted to be a writer. And
mm-hmm.
I think that drove a lot of the early, you know, urge to write until I probably discovered, you know, a little bit of discipline and some other motivations aside from, you know, that, you know, logorrhea. But...
Was he really happy and excited when your book came out, when Evolution of Shadows came out?
Yeah, I think at some point he came around. He saw that kind of I was not interested in anything else.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was mm-hmm. never an insensitive person. I just think he was scared.
Well, and as a parent, you know, I can imagine.
Yeah. And yeah, when, you know, after getting a degree in creative writing and going off to get an MFA, he's kind of
yeah,
okay, so it means something to you, you know. So he was there at the launch party and was very proud of the whole thing, and you know.
You know, I think sometimes. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, but it was, and then of course that was in October of 2009, and then in March of 2010 he passed away. So.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's probably still some unresolved stuff there, but you know, that's what writing's for, is to work on that and get rid of it, right?
Well, I'm glad he was so proud. I was going to clarify that as a parent, I think, you know, from the beginning I've known that my kids to some degree are who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you are born in some ways who you are. And then
right.
of course you're shaped by your parents, you're shaped by your environment, but in some way you have the genes you have, you mm-hmm. know, you are who you are to some degree. And So I've tried never to tell my children who they have to be.
Right.
But so when I was saying, yeah, your dad was probably, you know, a little bit scared mm-hmm. with your career choice, you know, what I was thinking is that it's not simply, oh my gosh, is he going to be able to have a good, you know, life and mm-hmm. pay his bills? It's not simply that. I think when children choose things that you don't expect, sometimes it's, oh my gosh, I hope it works out for him. I don't right. want him to get hurt.
Right.
You know, there's that sense of protectiveness mm-hmm. too.
Yeah.
And it's hard. It's oh, hard yeah. if you know a child is going to risk that.
Mm-hmm.
It's so much easier when a child just decides to do, you know,
accounting,
a really quantifiable kind of understandable thing.
Right.
But it's not simply about paying the bills. I think sometimes it's about knowing they're taking a leap and you can't protect them
mm-hmm.
and yeah. hoping that they'll land, you yeah. know,
yep.
safely.
I don't understand that from the parent's point of view, but I'm getting there, never having been a parent. But I wouldn't call it shame, but I call it regret that it took me, you know, age and experience and wisdom to understand what was going on there. When at the time that it happened, it was just this, you know, this kind of weird, childish, you know, emotional greed kind of.
Well, I mean, I don't think you should be too hard on yourself. I mean, maybe your dad could have been a little bit clearer about his right. own reaction to you, you know. I mean, it always takes, I think it always takes two
True.
In situations like that. And I don't think you need to be a parent. I mean, I think you can understand. I mean, I think you can imagine, especially
yeah.
someone like yourself, because of what empathy you've shown in a situation you didn't live through that you mm-hmm. wrote about, you know. I think you can imagine what it would be like to have a kid you really mm-hmm. care about, somebody oh. who's young and,
yeah.
you know, doesn't have a lot of maybe life experience. Or, mm-hmm. you know, just the thing is, you don't know if their work is any good really out there, you know, or their singing or their,
right.
or their sports. I mean, mm-hmm. how do you know where they really stand? And
yeah.
You can imagine how it would feel to hear that and
oh,
to
yeah.
think, oh my gosh, okay. You know, all right, go for it, man.
And I've certainly heard and read enough stories and, you know, some, that's the beautiful thing about literature and reading yeah. wonderful short stories and novels and ones that are well done and not cliche and formulaic is your brain doesn't know the difference really between what you've imagined and what you've experienced. Those are the mm-hmm. in your brain and your capacity for empathy, they hit the same place and achieve the same thing.
Right.
And
right.
That's why we have to foster readers. I mean, good grief.
Well, I agree. I believe this isn't my idea or my expression, but someplace I read, you know, it allows you truly to walk in someone else's shoes when
Absolutely.
You read.
Absolutely.
And I love that. I wish I'd written down who said it or saved it, but of course I didn't. So.
So here's, I've been dying. Who are your gals or your guys? Who are the writers that you would, I guess, who were the ones that turned you on? Who are the ones that you would carry with you to the desert island? Who are the ones that you hope you will be able to place your book next to and not be embarrassed by?
You know, this is going to be an interesting conversation because in some ways, I wrote for a long time more than I read.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I came to reading somewhat late. So, as I said, and you know, I would say that reading is sort of a passion and being absolutely critical to me.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't really happen until well into adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I mean, who would I take to a desert island? I guess I would have to say Milan Kundera.
Oh, wow.
I would have to say Louise Erdrich.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm going to forget somebody. This one doesn't go over well, but Hemingway.
Oh.
Yeah, a lot of people just still have issues with him, I guess.
But, yeah, some do. Some do.
But Hemingway would go with me. The first volume of William Manchester's biography about Churchill.
Oh, wow.
I think would go with me. I thought that was masterful. I still haven't read the other two volumes, but I blame that on life.
Right.
Probably one Barbara Pym would go with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to remember what the title was. I think it's A Quartet in Autumn.
Mm-hmm.
I would probably take that. I think that is of hers the best one I've read.
Mm-hmm.
Oh gosh. And, you know, I know I'm, oh, I would also want to take, I can see him. I can see the book is light. James Salter. I'd take James Salter with me.
Yeah.
And I know I'm forgetting some people. But those are the ones I think that I remember, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yep.
And there are other books I've loved. I'd probably take something from Jhumpa Lahiri too.
Oh. Oh wow.
But those So those are the folks. Those are the folks.
Yeah.
I've
got Hemingway in my past too. I think the problem with Hemingway, of course, I think is subjective. I think there was a time in the critical life of Hemingway's work where the negative feminist criticism, you know, held sway, and that became the accepted understanding of Hemingway. And that's not to say mm-hmm. that Hemingway doesn't have a problem or an issue with misogyny, but I found it. One of my favorite stories relating to my education and fondness for Hemingway was one of my American survey courses as an undergrad was taught by a professor who was a feminist critic, and he hated
mm-hmm.
Hemingway because of that. And so whenever Hemingway mm-hmm. would come up in the survey course, he would take that week off and bring a different professor in to teach those courses. Right.
You know what? That's really good of him, though. I mean, to recognize that there was no way he could address the fullness of the work. He mm-hmm. could only address its fault.
Right.
So good for him. But
at the time that I was taking that course, I had also read Sam Keen's book, Fire in the Belly. This was early 90s.
Oh, see, I haven't read that.
And which was...
Okay.
An early philosophical work of the men's movement before it got overtaken by the promise keepers and the men's rights jackasses.
Mm-hmm.
So it was actually based on legitimate philosophy and, you know, riffing off of Joseph Campbell and stuff like this, and trying to really wrestle with, you know, masculinity and how patriarchy is damaging to men and what we can do to short circuit that and get around it. And of course, it was overshadowed by Robert Bly's, you know, fairy tale book, Iron John, and then Promise Keepers showed up, and
mm-hmm.
Promise Keepers is just benevolent sexism ramped up to 10. So anyway.
No, I'm just listening because I haven't read any of these, and I never read Bly, and so.
Yeah. And then I'd also read Toni Morrison's little book of essays called Playing in the Dark, where she had a brilliant mm-hmm. essay on Hemingway. And
mm-hmm.
she made the point is that for all of Hemingway's problems, we can't continue to shellack those texts as if he didn't actually do something worth reading, as if that then makes mm-hmm. everything else he said worthless. And so I've been mm-hmm. reading that. And so in my survey course, when it came time to write the final paper about a short story mm-hmm. or something from the course, I picked Hemingway's Fathers and Sons and filtered that mm-hmm. through Morrison's analysis and the men's movement and, you know, how mm-hmm. patriarchy is damaging, and talked about how this story was actually showing Hemingway as a proto anti-patriarchal man, because because, you know, you have the scene in the beginning of that where he, you know, hides his hand-me-down underwear from his father under the rock. And his father finds it and beats him for it. And then he sits in the outhouse with a shotgun, you know, fantasizing about killing his father. And then you switch to them driving in the car with his son next to him sleeping, and how they have this completely different relationship to guns and hunting and violence
And you're thinking to myself, and here's this evolution of, you know, paternal gentleness.
And what was the response to that essay?
I have no idea. I just know I passed the class, and that was all that mattered.
Oh, yeah.
It was a final paper, so I never got it back. So
it's so interesting, because I don't think I read Fathers and Sons.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Although my memory seems... Yeah, I know. I'll have to go read it now. One of those gaps I was referring to earlier. But I too felt like though there were... I guess it's the whole notion of... there's one bad thing mean you throw everything out, you know,
right.
as Morrison was discussing. I felt that there were things of merit, and but one of the people who was going to read my comprehensive exam mm-hmm. was a feminist scholar, and I remember thinking, gosh, I hope I pass, you know. but she was very open, I think, to mm-hmm. hearing a different perspective, and you know,
right.
so yeah, it worked out. But I do think that there is stuff of merit to in his work that we need to
right.
to give him credit for.
Well,
but yeah, he would be in my bag. I'm sure I'm going to get off the phone and think of like four other people.
oh, that's okay.
Or more, but. But, you know, I think part of it, too, comes down to, you know, there are so much of my life in the last maybe 11, 12 years
mm-hmm.
has been reading different kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I would probably actually put a few children's books in my bag now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That I might, you know, and I still have many of my children's books, thanks to my mom. but, yeah, I guess that's... And there's a poet whose name has completely escaped me. I would put in William Maxwell as well.
Oh, okay.
So definitely William Maxwell.
Interesting.
Yeah. I'm not sure what you expected, but yeah,
no,
those are.
One of my favorite things about, you know, talking with writers is finding out, you know, what their chosen lineage is and where those, you know, who they have read and who, you know, fills in that backlog, who comes in and inspires them and everything. That's important, because then you can, if you look hard enough, you can see those echoes, you know.
That's interesting.
Hmm? Oh, yeah.
I think that's interesting.
Laird Hunt, who was a Naropa grad,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
When I sit and I read his books, I know who some of his lineage is, because we both went to graduate school. We both liked Michael Ondaatje, and you can see in his work that influence of Ondaatje and some of the other writers that he is, which I can't remember off the top of my head, but I spot that one easy.
That's interesting. That's
but I can
so
see those threads, and I go, oh, and then you can just follow those books back. So that's how I, you know, I went to graduate school and. Michael Ondaatje was there my first summers, you know, on a panel with Robert Creeley and Robin Blazer. And just because of being exposed to Ondaatje, I went and read his books. And because my advisor was a friend of his, she said, well, you know, this is inspired a lot by John Berger. So I went and I picked up John Berger, you know, and...
Interesting, yeah.
And then found out that both of them kind of had this thing, you know, that there was this whole clique of people that were associated. They got inspiration or something from Lawrence Durrell. So I went and I picked up Lawrence Durrell, you know?
Okay.
And
yeah.
Henry Green.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I love that. I mean, because, you know, you hook into that lineage, whatever it is you choose to hook into, and you carry those people forward with you. And maybe someday someone's saying, oh, you know, the writer that inspired me was Caitlin Hamilton Sumi. And then we can go back and there's Louise Erdrich mm-hmm. and there's all these other people, and nobody ever really dies in this profession, you know?
that's a neat perspective. Nobody ever dies. I like that. You should write about that. You should write an essay about that.
Maybe I'll try. I think I've been trying to in one fashion or another since I was, you know, maybe 27 or so, but I don't know.
I like that concept. I think you should write that up and send it to LitHub or something. That would be good.
I've been thinking of something.
That'd be good.
So we've been at it for an hour, and I got my last question I want to ask before we
wrap it up. That went fast. Okay.
And I think this is going to be interesting. I ask this of everybody in one form or another, and I think both for you as a writer and a book publicist, this will be really, really interesting to see what your answer is that, and we've sort of brushed up against it before. So here we are every year, you know, the National Endowment for the Arts and other people do these reports, and they tell us that literary reading is in decline. People are not reading books. And you take a look at like Amazon and their self-published, you know, the serialized genre stuff that seems to be, you know, just flying and selling like mad. And here we are. We're not part of that group of serialized genre, basically a linguistic TV show type of writing where you pick that serial and you just pump them out as fast as you can for a steadfast audience. We're more artists. And if everything is in decline, what can we as writers be doing out in the community to foster, to grow, to expand that ecosystem that will allow us to have a future in this, to actually maybe make something approaching a living as writers? What can we do to get people to maybe step beyond that learned helplessness, that doubt about their native intelligence that they've acquired, you know, from bad literature courses and too much TV? And so what can we do to grow our ecosystem and keep an audience?
Well, I think one of the things, one thing that's been really interesting is that there are a couple of reviewers on Goodreads who've reviewed my book, and they say something like, I think there's maybe three or four. I don't really enjoy short stories, but I enjoyed these, and this is why.
Right.
And they're some of my favorite people, because, of course, I'm hugely grateful and relieved that they did like them, mm-hmm. that they even gave them a chance. And I think there's something to be said for all of us welcoming people into the fold. I feel like we can all be pretty snobby sometimes. And so I think it's important to say, hey, if you don't like literary fiction, that's okay. What do you like? Mm-hmm. I mean, I love mysteries, Jason. Right. I love them. So, you know, I think part of it is that we have sort of created a culture where some books are good and some books aren't, and mm-hmm. I think that hurts us all.
Right.
So I think we could be less snobby, and I'm sure there are people out there who are listening who are saying that some books are better than others. Well, of course, some cookies are better than others. Some right. dishes are better than others. Mm-hmm. But I think if we all want to celebrate reading and literature and literary achievement, mm-hmm. As you say, it's important to acknowledge that readers read all kinds of things, mm-hmm. and perhaps by being more open about people reading something that may or may not seem as artistic, you know, maybe by being more receptive to a larger conversation, mm-hmm. we'll encourage people to pick up a book that they might not otherwise try,
right.
that isn't perhaps in their wheelhouse, and we'll see what happens. I mean, I think that's when I saw that people were at least trying the stories. I thought, wow, you know, uh-huh. I'm really lucky they gave it a try, and I'm really, really lucky they liked it. So I don't know. I just think if we could just be a little bit more open to a larger uh-huh. conversation, that we might all surprise ourselves, because I think we might all read all kinds of different things and find that maybe, you know, where you don't see artistic merit, you recognize some great plotting. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, of course, we need to encourage the kids. And I will say that being a parent, in our community anyway, there's such a huge emphasis on reading. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my fifth grader is not allowed to just go into school and sit and talk until school starts. They're to be quiet and they're to read.
Yeah.
And they're not actually supposed to be doing homework. They're supposed to be reading.
Nice.
So I think that they are working really hard. And I know that, you know, being in one of the southern states that doesn't rank as high in the education ratings and rankings, it might
neither
be
does Kansas, so, you know, it's like,
I think you're higher than we are, though, but it might be heartening for people to hear that in this part of, in the city, that reading is really fundamental and encouraged. And so, and then I think encouraging writing.
Yeah.
Because I think writers do read. Mm-hmm. So getting the kids to step out and give it a whirl and try a book or try a story.
Right.
Will encourage them.
Yep.
So, and then of course, last but not least, if we all want to survive where we can, when we can, we need to buy books.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I just bought two today, so.
Okay, you're ahead of me. You're ahead of me.
Well, you know, it's actually, well, there are three things now. One, in your answer, I sense the old bookseller in a way. You know,
yeah.
One of the lessons I learned as a bookseller was every writer is somebody's favorite writer. So keep your mouth shut and just sell them the book they want, you know?
Yeah.
And then when it comes to reading.
But also.
Oh,
go ahead. No,
but also.
Well, the other thing I would say is that if it's within the realm of possible interest to them, sell them the book you love.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. What I tried to do.
And then you were going to say something else before I rudely interrupted. I apologize.
Reading in schools, absolutely. And I think we do a huge disservice to kids when we focus so heavily on the STEM subjects and think like, oh, reading will just take care of itself. I think it was a writer friend of mine, Michelle Mercer. She did a couple of books on, she did a book on Wayne Shorter, did a book on Joni Mitchell. And she's a commentator every now and then for NPR. But she said she was sitting on a ski lift and she was talking to a young 14-year-old girl who said she was going to go into, you know, biochemical engineering. And made some comment and Michelle made some comment about writing or something like that. And the girl was like, oh, that'll all be done by AI in the future. And I thought,
wow.
But not fiction, not art, not what? But
well, that's not happening in Knoxville, Tennessee. In Knoxville, Tennessee, there are at least 10 kids who are already writing their own novels.
Yeah.
And that does not include mine. Right. So.
But the other thing also about school, and I don't know how your experiences were in high school with English and literature courses. And I know other people that have looked at me funny when I've told them about my experience and they're like, oh, that's not true. Kind of using the personal experience to debunk a more general experience. And because I've had a lot of other people confirm this as well, is that in high school lit courses, you're kind of all directed towards one answer when discussing a piece of literature. And to me, that's like the hugest mistake in the world, because if you got some kid in the back that thinks something different about the story the way I always did, and then you say, no, we're trying to get to this one spot, then if they're not a stubborn jerk like I am, they'll either think that they're not smart enough to get literature, and so they stop reading, or they keep reading, but they choose writers that go out of their way to insult their intelligence and think, well, that's all I'm smart enough to understand. And so they never want to pick up anything else because they're scared to.
That's interesting. I don't remember. I really don't remember. I had such a fabulous teacher. I remember her name, but I don't remember. Her name was Lois Anderson. I don't remember feeling guided toward one answer.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I'm sure that
I'm jealous that of the people happen, that had that. I'm jealous of everybody.
Well, I don't remember. I mean, maybe if I called some gals from high school and said, what was it like? They might say, yeah, it was just like that, Caitlin. Mm-hmm. But that's not how I remember it.
Right.
And I think that it's going to be interesting to see what happens going forward. School is very different now. It'll be interesting to see what happens for my kids.
Yep.
It is, at least here, they're doing stuff I didn't do. I mean, my oldest child in third grade did something I was doing in seventh.
Wow.
Yeah. And first presentations and reports to the class in front of the class were in second grade. I was playing with pipe cleaners in second grade, people. I was not prepared to give a report on my child up there giving a report on Abraham Lincoln. I'm like, what? So
almost makes us seem like we grew up developmentally disabled.
It's very interesting. I mean, and I think that there's a lot to be said for increasing the emphasis here, especially in this state, on academics, because we do need to catch up.
Yep.
And there are other things that come with that. You know, it's a lot more stress earlier, yada, yada, yada. But I don't know, man. I don't remember feeling channeled or silent.
That's interesting.
But I've always been one to speak my mind. Uh-huh. I was in public school. I was not in private school.
Right. But were you in, like, advanced placement courses, AP classes?
Yes, I was.
I'm finding that probably is the dividing line. I was not in the AP courses because I...
Well, that may be.
I was horrible at handing in my homework. So I never got above a C in a high school English class ever.
Well, that may be. They may have allowed more free-form discussion in the AP classes. I remember in my AP history classes, huge debates. Mm-hmm. And so that's interesting. We'll see. I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see what it's like now. But.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm beginning to think that's the dividing line, is that they let the go, and then, you know, the average student is just like, you should think this about this story, and so we can get on with it, and you can work on, you know, identifying the verb in this sentence from the grammar book. And it's like, get them to...
If that's the dividing line, what a pity, though, because there are a lot of kids who are very bright, who learn differently and who could well be in honors, you know, who may not choose to be in honors. There's so many factors that go into it. And I know they have to make a decision based on what they've got, which is a grade or a test score. I understand. Yep. They can, you know, but what a pity if that's the dividing line, because there are a lot of really smart kids who just...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Huh.
I think every decent writer you come across who was a bad student at high school is one of those kids. I'm over
Isn't
here
that interesting? I think
waving wildly, going, "Yeah, me."
Oh man! Well, I don't remember. I wish I could, but I will let you know in a couple of years what I see.
Okay.
I hope you still have your podcast going.
Oh well, yeah. It's the thing that's
your new book
me
out
interested. So yeah, cool. Well,
your new book out.
I'm going to stop the recording here for a minute. Don't go anywhere.
Okay.
So thanks for talking to me.
Oh my gosh, it was a blast. Thank you. Yeah, I loved it. Thank you so much. I feel really honored that you selected me. Thank you.
I always pick the writers I'm interested in, which is why I've gone.
Well, that's
to
a big compliment.
Well, I don't know. I'm not that important, am I? No, I'm not. Anyway.
Well, I mean, you are in my world.
Okay.
So, I mean, I was really, really happy. I was very touched that I got picked. So thank you.
Well, I hope people go out and buy your book a lot, some more, because they should.
Well, thank you. I hope so. I don't know. It, you know, small press realities. We'll see. But I'm really, really just touched and grateful for all the people who've read it and been kind to it, like yourself. I mean, I feel really good about it all.
Well, good.
However many have sold, you know. So.
Well, we'll see if we can get some more sold. So.
Well, thank you.